Hey, has lichen sclerosis messed with your relationships? You know, partner, family, friends, even at work? Then you need to join us at the Holistic Healing Summit this May 13th to the 17th, because we're bringing all the experts. We're going to be talking about intimacy, sex, as well as how do you talk to your family, friends, provider, boss, all of those things. And this is a free event, live, virtually, so you can catch it anywhere in the world, May 13th to the 17th, from 9 a.m. to 9 p.m. We've got sessions going on all day. Get more information at lssupportnetwork.org/WHS. That's lssupportnetwork.org/WHS.
This meeting is being recorded.
All right. Welcome, 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 everyone. I am so excited for our National Vulva Awareness Day event, LS Revealed. And this is the first time we're doing a live panel. And we're so excited to have our experts here, which is doubly amazing because they are also LSSN board members. So we have an amazing board and talented board. And these are some of our board members. So I'm going to go ahead and introduce everyone. If you followed us for a while, I have no doubt you know Jacqueline, our patient advocate, who is the creator and author of the Lost Labia Chronicles. Welcome, Jacqueline.
Thank you.
And we have our resident gynecologist, and she is also has a podcast, much like myself, and a blog. So I put all of the links for her in the show notes. In the chat for you guys. So go and follow her, Dr. Susan Weber. Welcome.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Absolutely. And Dr. Mamawa Baroque, pelvic health physical therapist in residence. She's all about, you might remember her actually from last year's Holistic Healing Summit, her amazing talk on sexual health and LS. Welcome.
I'm so happy to be here.
Yes. So I want to make sure we get all of our time in. I want to go over a few housekeeping things. You feel free to show your camera. You will not be recorded. Only myself and our guests will be recorded. This recording will be available to you if you want to rewatch on our YouTube page as of tomorrow. And if you want, we also have our closed caption available. If you just scroll down to the bottom, you'll see CC and you'll show your closed captioning. I will try to grab questions out of the chat. I will also be putting a poll live where you can drop your questions in there as well. So I will be taking questions from the poll first. And then if we have time, then I will be going back and trying to grab them out of the chat. So let's get started. So we are going to be focusing on lichen sclerosis and sexual health. The first couple of questions that I have are going to be on treatment and management. We had posted this on Instagram and we've got some questions. I want to start off with you, Dr. Weber. There were a lot of questions around LS and progression. As we know, LS is a progressive condition, and if it is not managed and treated, it can progress. And so a couple of the questions came in, and it was concerning more fusing and resorption. And one of the questions, or a few of the questions, was, is it inevitable? Can LS progression be prevented? And if so, how?
That's a good question. I think the problem with progression in the past was that as gynecologists, we were just trained to diagnose the condition, treat it twice a day with clobetasol for 2 weeks, and then reduce the steroids. And we didn't always see these patients back. And so I think that's a lot of the problem, and that women would go very long periods of time between exams. But I think now we've really recognized the progressive nature of lichen sclerosis. And so we use steroids for a longer period of time, and it really depends on the person. We taper it down very slowly, and we stick with maintenance therapy as well, in addition to all of the other vulvar care things that we can be doing as well to really protect that skin barrier. But I think that was a lot of the issue with progression. So I have a lot of patients, we identify the lichen sclerosis, we treat it, and they do very well. And once they're in remission or they're doing very well, I tell them at a minimum for the rest of their life, they need to be seen yearly. And then, of course, if they have any symptoms come up, they need to be seen, sooner than that, of course. So there's a lot of education that goes around that.
Awesome. So, as long as we are treating, there's a good chance that we're going to stop and halt that progression, is what I'm hearing you say.
I have had a couple of patients. They were older patients and they progress. And I think, sometimes there's in our society, we tell women over 65, they don't need to be seen. And so by the time they come in, their disease is so bad that, you're really fighting against that. Then there are some other health issues and sometimes ability to get the medication in the right place. So there are a couple women I've seen with pretty bad progression of it during treatment, and then sometimes there relapses in treatment as well. But that's been my experience.
Jacqueline, do you want to add anything?
So for people that don't know me, that don't know my journey, pretty much in 2 weeks, it will be 4 years that my lichen sclerosis has been in remission. Not only is it in remission, but I haven't had any symptoms or quality of life issues in those 4 years. And on the topic of prevention, specifically scarring and fusing, ever since I started using topical corticosteroids consistently, I have not had any more progression than what I started with. So once I kind of got things under control, it has seemed to kind of halt things for me. That said, I do try to take a very humble and kind of realistic approach to it, which is that there are no guarantees in life. I'm doing the best I can according to the best science that we have right now, and things could change in the future, but I'm just going to keep doing what I'm doing and hope for the best.
Thank you and congratulations. 4 years is huge. All right. So our next question is, if someone doesn't want to use the steroids, are there any other natural or maintenance options once you do get into remission?
Right. Well, fortunately, steroids are very effective. And when they're used correctly, there are minimal risks. And that's always been an issue, with around education, too. I think that when women go pick up their prescription at the pharmacy, they're told by the pharmacist, don't use this more than 2 weeks. And they don't really understand that we are treating a condition that requires ongoing and long-term treatment. So used correctly, the risks of topical steroids in a small amount is going to be very low. And I think that's another issue. Sometimes women aren't educated that they don't need to be slapping on a tablespoon of steroids. It really takes a tiny, tiny amount. And so you're going to absorb very little of those steroids. And there are other medications that we use to treat lichen sclerosis, like Elidel or their topical calcineurin medications. I don't use those very often. I've been very fortunate. I have some patients that use them. They can cause a little bit more burning, and they also have a black box warning that they can increase certain cancers as well. So they're, I usually go with steroids because it's generally tried and true, and I know the risks. I am unaware of any natural products that would work for lichen sclerosis. We know that testosterone is a no. So if anybody tries to treat you with testosterone, run away. And then I think vulvar care. I mean, for many years, we haven't treated women with maintenance steroids, and a lot of those women have done fine. But now the standard of care, of course, is to use maintenance steroids. But vulvar care 101 can help a lot as well, just with protecting that skin barrier from inflammation and maybe other factors that could cause a recurrence that we don't know about. But I don't know of anything otherwise natural.
And when you say vulvar care, do you mean like using oil emollients and barrier creams and things like that?
Right. I mean, just not using wipes, not using drying soaps, just using plain warm water, to emollients. Like, I usually recommend petrolatum or Vaseline because it has very minimal, has one ingredient in it. Some people do well with Aquaphor, some women do very well with coconut oil, just really protecting that delicate skin.
Awesome. Thank you. Did you want to add anything, Jacqueline?
Yes, actually. So I was reading this paper the other day, and I don't recall the authors. I think it was a 2013 publication, and they were comparing steroids. It was like a three-arm trial. They were looking at steroids, vitamin E, and then a cold cream. A cold cream is basically a bland kind of moisturizer. And what they wanted to test was, once in remission, can we put people on vitamin E as maintenance or a cold cream as maintenance instead of having them continue with steroids? And what they found was that the steroid group had no relapses, so they stayed in remission consistently. And both the vitamin E and the cold cream group, don't quote the percentage, but they had, I think, about 50% relapses in both of those groups. So just kind of showing, and there are big, big, big studies going on right now looking into maintenance therapy and what the ideal dosage should be. But I think where we're at is that steroids is going to be the best treatment, even into remission. And then there's absolutely a place for these adjuncts like vitamin E oil or any kind of emollient. Vulvar care, as Dr. Weber was referring to, we keep those obviously for overall vulvar health and just making things optimal. But I think in terms of like having a study show that these things are effective as treatments, it hasn't been shown yet.
Thank you. That's a great, great point. So then going into different areas of the genitals, when we're talking about treatments, do we treat the different areas any differently? So like for the clitoris versus the labia versus the anus, are there any nuances on treatment? We'll start with you, Dr. Weber.
It really depends on the person. I don't generally vary the treatment as far as starting with clobetasol and then just vulvar care, perineal care, anal care. One thing I didn't mention is that, sometimes we can have urinary leakage, or we can have, maybe we have loose bowels, or we have problems with stool leakage and things like that. So a lot of times, just hygiene with water. I usually have women get a squirt bottle and rinse off, or if they have a bidet, great, something like that, just to rinse off and really just pat dry or let dry. And that can really wash away a lot of our irritants like urine, sweat, feces, and things like that. So different parts of our genital area may need and anal area may need to be treated differently depending on what's going on. Or I tell someone if they absolutely need to use a wipe, I hate wipes, but water wipes. If you feel like you need that to get clean around your anus, you can use that. That's 99% water. And then emollients for everywhere. You don't want to put Vaseline and other emollients inside the vagina, but on the vulva and perianal area. But generally, I do have clobetasol as a first line treatment. I do have one lady who feels like clobetasol works great for her vulvar area, periclitoral area, but she uses one of the calcineurin medications around her anus, and she's just found that that works best for her. So it's really a process of finding a treatment plan, following up, making sure it works, changing things around. It's not you see somebody once and then you're good to go. So
Thank you. So what I'm hearing you say is, in
well, I guess.
general, it's all the same, but in the around the anus, you may need something a little less strong than the ultra potent steroid, and topical calcineurin inhibitors are an option.
Right. One thing I forgot to mention is that a lot of women, not all, of course, like Jacqueline will can be menopausal or postmenopausal. And so as an extra treatment, which I think there's very few reasons that someone in postmenopause can't and shouldn't use a vaginal estrogen, but sometimes using a vulvar and vaginal estrogen that can help as well, using a cream or a tablet or something like that. Creams are helpful sometimes just to apply to the opening of the vagina, especially if there's some scarring and things like that, just generally trying to keep those tissues in healthy condition. And lichen sclerosis generally is not going to be inside the vagina, but it's all connected and there's estrogen receptors from the vagina down to the vulva. So that's can be an extra well, not extra, but added treatment for vulvar care, especially after menopause.
Awesome. Thank you. Jacqueline, did you want to add anything?
I can add from a lived experience perspective. So when I apply my clobetasol, even in remission, I basically apply it to all of the non-hair bearing parts or parts that would be non-hair bearing. So for me, that's around the clitoral area. That's where the labia minora would be. I kind of hesitated there because they're technically not there. So I kind of go off of like there's a color difference so I can see where they've resorbed. So I'll put it around there. I do put around the vaginal opening, the fourchette, and the perineum. That's where I apply. So basically anything that's non-hair bearing, that's where I apply. And I've been applying it that way pretty much for 4 years consistently and haven't had any issues. That said, of course, everybody is individual with lichen sclerosis. And one thing that I always tell people, because there is a lot of confusion about where should I apply? Is it safe here? Is it not? I tell them to basically, before their appointment, I say print out a diagram of a vulva, bring a couple highlighters with you, and then tell your provider with this yellow highlighter, draw on this model where you want me to apply the clobetasol. If I have a stubborn area, maybe there's like a really thick area of skin, and you want me to focus rubbing it in there an extra minute, write that on my sheet so that when I go home, I have something physical that I can reference. Because I don't know about everybody listening in, but I get very anxious and overwhelmed when I go into the doctor's office, and I probably retain about 50, no, not 50, that's being way too generous. I probably retain like 10% of what's told to me. It's not because I'm a stubborn patient. It's not because I'm, no, I don't want to listen to you. It's just because I get so overwhelmed. So by the time I get home, I'm like, oh crap. Where did they tell me to put that again? I can't remember. And so having that physical reference for me is very, very important. I can go back, and if ever I have any doubt, I'm just like, nope, yep, that area is definitely yellow. Okay, I know where to apply. So that's my advice for people that are still kind of uncertain. That kind of physical feedback can be really helpful.
Great suggestion. Great suggestion. So I'm going to start this next question with you, Jacqueline. Do you need to be in remission to engage in sexual activity?
Yeah, so that's a great, great, great question. And the answer is not so clear, if I'm being honest. So the majority of the research on sexual health and lichen sclerosis is more so looking at what are the sexual health impacts of living with lichen sclerosis, and then testing different interventions to help improve those. But they're not so much giving guidelines on how to have sex with vulvar lichen sclerosis. And so in the absence of any evidence-based information and in the absence of any specific guidelines, I think we really have to just listen to our bodies a little bit. And so for this, I would say, if it was with me personally, I don't know that you have to be in remission proper to have sex, but I personally would at least want my symptoms to be quite well managed and for the skin overall to be looking pretty healthy. So when I wouldn't engage in sexual activity with my genitals would be if I had any active open cuts, fissures, anything open like that, I would probably refrain. Oral penetration, anything like that, I would at least wait until those areas heal up. I also probably wouldn't want to engage in sexual activity if I was very symptomatic. If I'm very itchy, I'm not feeling in the mood. I'm not thinking, oh yeah, this is what I want to do right now. Same thing if I'm in pain, I'm not really going to be vibing to that. So I don't know, again, that I would say that you need to be in remission proper, but I do think you'd want to pay attention and pay attention to your symptoms and how you're feeling. And if symptoms are low, if symptoms are well managed, there's no active cuts, tears, fissures that might dissuade you temporarily, then I say go for it safely, consensually, and slowly. Listen to your body. There is this tendency for us to rush through sexual activity. That often comes from a place of trying to please the other person, and we're putting our own pleasure in the background. So we're just trying to rush through it, but slow things down. And if things aren't feeling good, communicate that midway. Can we change positions? This is not working for me. Can we switch from genital focus to a different part of the body and work that way? I will say that I wasn't fully in official remission, and I remember asking my gynecologist, am I allowed to have sex? Because I didn't know. I was like, I don't know. Like, do I need his permission? By his, I mean the gynecologist. Like, does he need to sign off and be like, you're good to go? I wasn't sure. And he basically told me, like, absolutely go for it. Just safe, slow, be mindful, and listen to your body. So I think that's kind of how I would approach this in the absence of any specific guidelines or literature telling us what to do.
Thank you. Great, great advice. If everyone can please keep their volume muted. Oh, we're getting some feedback, please. Thank you. All right. Does anyone want to add to that about remission?
I'd actually like to add something. Can you hear me?
I think some of the things that Jacqueline said were very spot on. I'd like to add on to that about just how to jump into sexual activity. So I think we underestimate the value of foreplay, and foreplay not necessarily in the moment, but also foreplay as you progress in your day. So that's, for instance, a lot of my patients, what we will discuss is how they navigate the day if they have planned. So planning sexual activity is a form of a way to prepare your body, preparing your mind by maybe watching or reading erotica so that you're thinking about it and having your natural vaginal lubricants be kind of in the forefront of things. Also being mindful of the type of lubricants that you use and making sure that they can help sustain that lubrication throughout sexual activity. And I'm referring to penis and vagina sexual activity or sexual toys. Those are some of the things that usually can kind of shift the energy if things are not going well. And so preparing by using lubricants, as a physical therapist that treats pelvic dysfunction, is a lot of the things that I would encourage people to utilize. When it comes to positioning, you mentioned that before. I find that being on top, which is not across the board, allows you to be in more control of the descent and just kind of your movement versus missionary, which traditionally seems like it is the traditional position that people go to for sexual activity, for sex. But in many cases, if you're actually on top, and that might be on a chair or even in the bed, those things can really help to gradually go into sexual activity. Also placing something underneath your hips so that your hips are aligned in a way that you're not causing so much tension on the opening of the vagina. That would be what I would say to maybe consider as well.
Awesome. Well, that leads us right into the next question.
which is someone who wrote in that they are transitioning from dilator work to penetration, and they're apprehensive, right? It's that transition. So some of those positionings could be helpful with that as well. Is there any other advice from transitioning from dilators to penetration in particular?
Yeah. So one of the things I would say, and it just depends on how you, an individual feels about this, but I find that sometimes, you know, just kind of exploring various types of sexual toys can be a way that you're just very more knowledgeable of your body. And what I mean by that is there's certain toys that are not necessarily the shape of a penis in a traditional dildo. It would be something that's a little bit smaller, that's less intimidating, that you are able to explore some external stimulation prior to exploring internal stimulation. I would encourage people to have a conversation, let's just start there, with your partner, so that this is not a scenario where you just kind of, you know, have to go quiet, so to speak. You have to kind of vocalize. I worked once with a sex therapist that said you're responsible for your own sexual pleasure. And what they meant by that is you have to speak up and say the things that you enjoy. And if you're not comfortable or really knowledgeable about the things that bring you joy, it can be rather challenging to help your partner navigate that. And so if those are things that you're already on the fence about, you might want to consider talking to a sex or relationship or intimacy therapist to give you the words to be able to describe or say the things, because not everybody's very comfortable talking about sex. And so having somebody to be able to lean into, like, what do I say? Like, you know, can be very helpful. But even if you don't, you know, want to use that avenue, just even within yourself, like I said about self-exploration, erotica, just really getting the brain, the sexual pleasure areas in your brain stimulated can really help change how your physical body feels in that as well.
Great points. I want to also highlight for our group, you guys are getting an exclusive, one-day exclusive, starting tomorrow. For our Holistic Healing Summit, we, with our All Access Pass, you're getting a bonus. So there are 14 video replays from our past Holistic Healing Summits. And one of those sessions is on sexual toys. And it's a whole hour of going through the different type of toys, specifically for people with LS. Why, you know, what's good and, you know, what, why this toy would be good for you versus not. And so that is a valuable replay for this particular situation as well. There's others as well, especially around sexual health. So there's a Dr. Heather Jeffcoat, her session on dilator work is also in there. So she goes through the different dilators and why you would use the different type of dilators. And then her book, which Jacqueline used in order to get to pain-free sex, is also talked about in that session. So both of those are free with your All Access Pass to the Holistic Healing Summit. If you don't know what the Holistic Healing Summit is, it is our annual event where we bring experts from all different types of fields to help you learn how to live with this condition from a whole body approach. We'll be sending you out more emails, but you heard it here first. You get that bonus. So thank you for that. The next question is similar. But maybe you have even more advice. What's the best, I'm gonna start with Jacqueline in this one. What's the best approach to sexual activity when you're living with LS? This particular person is fine during intercourse, but they have pain and burning afterwards. So what could you tell them from your lived experience?
Yeah, so I think there's two parts to this question. So one is just, what is the best approach to sexual intimacy when we have lichen sclerosis? And I don't think there is a best approach, because we're all so unique, not just in the way that VLS manifests in our bodies, how we experience symptoms, how we respond to treatment, but we all come from such unique, different backgrounds. And we're coming to the sexual table with so much history. So I don't think it would make sense that we would all have this uniform way of approaching sexual health and sexual intimacy. I want to echo a lot of what Mamawa said. I think a lot of this is rooted in self-discovery. And a lot of us were never given that opportunity for self-discovery, because it's just not the society that at least I lived in. This was never really something that was mentioned to me as something that I could do and something that I can explore. So what does that mean? Kind of again to Mamawa's point, read erotica, listen to erotica. What about certain stories did you like? What didn't you like? Start knowing, what are my likes? What are my dislikes? What are my curiosities? I don't know if I'm going to like this, but that sounds kind of exciting. I'd like to maybe try this. Knowing these things. And then I think again, communication with your partner, with your partners, with potential partners, is going to be important. A lot of us are not used to asking for what we need. And that can be really hard and really scary and really darn intimidating in the beginning. And again, to Mamawa's point, I do think that is something that can be explored with an intimacy coach, a sex education coach, sex therapist, anyone that works in that space. That can be a safe space for you to start peeling the layers back and then figuring out, how do I even talk to this person about this? Because great, I listened to erotica, I figured out what I like, I want to try this. I don't know how to tell my partner this. And I'm really worried they're going to shut me down or judge me or something like this. Or I've never asked for what I want in my life, and I don't know how to do that. That can be a safe space to kind of explore that. So I think at the heart of it, it's about curiosity and getting to know yourself and giving yourself that gift of self-discovery, because it really is a gift. So I think that would be, you know, to answer the first question. To answer the second question, I've had a lot of people talk to me about this, and they'll say, you know, I feel okay during sexual activity. There's penis and vagina. I don't feel pain. I don't feel tearing. I don't feel any kind of warning sign that would cue me into maybe I should stop or modify. But then 2 hours later, my vulva's on fire. What's going on? Why is this happening? So I can talk about, you know, a couple things that you may do afterwards to kind of manage this. But I think at the heart of this is you're going to want to try and figure out what's causing this. Is this a pelvic floor related issue? Is this an LS related issue? And then once you figure out what issue it is, seeing the appropriate healthcare provider for that. My gynecologist probably isn't going to do too much for me if it's pelvic floor related, but my pelvic floor PT will. Right. So I think one part of that is to try and figure out what's going on and what's causing this. In the interim, there can be things that you can do to kind of reduce the pain or the burning that you're going through. I know that for me, my instinct would be to grab a private pack, which is a non-toxic gel pad that you can put in the freezer. You can also heat them, but that's not so much what we're going to do for burning. They come with a protective sleeve because we never want to apply ice directly to the skin because we don't want a cold injury. And you can place that on the vulva. So once that burning starts, you might want to just put that on, and maybe that can just quell the burning down for you. So that would be my go-to thing. So there are things that you can maybe do to manage, but I think the core of it is to try and figure out, is this LS related or is there something else going on, so that you can get the appropriate treatment for that.
Great, great answer. I also want to highlight, we are going to have Dr. Caroline Klein, who's going to be talking at the Holistic Healing Summit, and she's going to be giving actually a whole hour of tips and practices that you can do about talking to your partner about
like these things, this intimacy, how to grow that sexual intimacy. And then her all access session is going to be answering those questions and also helping us to craft that conversation, how you were talking about, like, how do I bring that up? How do I talk about those things? So we're gonna be having that. So again, all access pass, so valuable. And we have another Dr. Katrina Bouchard, who's going to be also talking about having not just an intimacy conversation with your partner, but talking about LS in as well. How do we have those conversations where we're not scaring our partner, but also still being able to have that intimacy? Because I know I get a lot, you know, my partner's scared to touch me because they don't want to hurt me. They don't want to cause me pain, but I also still want to be able to talk to them. So how do we have those conversations? Really, really important. So I want to go next to Dr. Weber from a gynecologist approach, because Jacqueline had made a great point. We need to find out what is the underlying condition that is causing that burning, that pain after we have sex. So from a gynecologist, can you tell us, and then I'm going to go to you, Dr. Burrow.
Right. So a couple of things I was thinking while we were discussing that was that if you've been struggling with the LS for a while, or changes, maybe you didn't know it was LS, and you've been having pain with intercourse already, it can take a lot of time and extra work really to break that pain cycle. And so it's going to be normal to not be interested in sexual activity. And it's going to be normal. Your body is going to try to protect itself in that situation. I have patients that come in that have pain with intercourse and they do fine with an exam. But when they're in the intimate moment, they really struggle with that because that's the trigger at that point. So first is really not rushing things. It can take a long, long time to get back to whatever normal sexual function you desire. It can take a lot of communication. And also if there are pelvic floor muscles that are overactive and contributing to the pain, that can require pelvic physical therapy as well. The other thing is that, you know, what we call foreplay for most of us is the main play. You know, only about a third of women are achieving orgasm with vaginal intercourse alone. And so really the clitoris is where it's at. And so I agree with the self-exploration and really learning what your body responds to. And then with LS as well, due to adhesions and things like that, you can require more clitoral stimulation if the clitoris is somewhat buried by labial fusion. And so employing things like vibrators or, you know, clitoral suction devices or topical things that sometimes can enhance genital arousal. Obviously, you have to be careful with whatever chemicals and ingredients are in that, but those can be things that can help as well. Oh, I forgot what I was going to say. Oh, and then also, if you are perimenopausal or in a low estrogen state, maybe someone's breastfeeding or someone's postmenopausal and they have a vulva and a vagina that really is suffering from lack of estrogen, then that can cause issues with sexual function as well and decreased sensitivity and pain. So like Jacqueline said, it's important to figure out what's causing that. And Mamawa alluded some to different lubricants. So really seeing what's in your products. I like silicone-based lubricants a lot because they don't have water in them. They're not going to affect the pH of the vagina. They're not going to increase your risk of infections. They're very slippery. But, you know, certainly there are lots of women that do well with water-based lubricants, but you have to really look at what you're applying down there. And a lot of products are just marketed to women about smelling good and being clean and warmth. You know, you don't want anything that increases warmth down there because that's going to change the pH balance of the vagina. So you really got to look critically at what you're using. And then the cold packs, cool packs, not freezer packs, rinsing, plain warm water can really do wonders for that part of our body. So.
Yeah, I can definitely attest. You do not want to use anything that has that warming or cooling effect on in your lube.
Yeah. Vulvar specialist I heard at a conference always said, Vagisil will make you ill and benzocaine will bring you pain. So those are readily available over the counter, or women use them all the time, and those actually can make things so much worse. So,
So someone in the chat said that they recall some medical provider recommended increasing your frequency of steroid use and burial ointment prior to sexual activity or activities like bike riding. Is that true?
You know, I've never really recommended that. If somebody is in active treatment, I have them using it once a day. And if somebody is on maintenance, they're using their maintenance, you know, once or twice a week, or maybe they're adding their estrogen in, but really I haven't utilized that strategy. I wouldn't personally, but okay. I suppose if you feel like biking or some other activity really increases, you could increase your maintenance from once to twice a week. Or I have some ladies that haven't been able to get down to once weekly application. They are still at twice weekly. I mean, you really have to figure out what works for you. Or I have some women who are able to decrease from clobetasol to triamcinolone, a much less lower potency steroid. So there's a lot of playing around to figure out what really works for the individual. So that may be something.
Jacqueline, go ahead.
Yeah, I have to agree with Dr. Weber. I've not heard that recommendation from any LS specialist or gynecologist at any conference or anything like that. I don't think I would use clobetasol more than it was prescribed to me by my provider, because a lot of the risks that people worry about when it comes to steroid use can occur in environments where we're overusing the steroid. Things like the skin getting super red, raw, inflamed, increased recurrent vulvar yeast infections, things like this. So I don't think I personally would opt for that. That said, I don't know if I heard this correctly, but I think they said they were told to increase their steroid and their emollient. I think the emollient is fine to increase. And in fact, the way that I view how I apply my emollient is based on how I feel. So before I menstruate, I have a week where I'm much drier. So I'm going to apply my emollient a lot more often during that week. Also, I am a very active gym goer. And if I have a very busy day and I'm going to be working out, I will apply more emollient. I'm not applying more clobetasol because I don't want to start moving into overuse territory. I'm just going to follow that as prescribed. But emollient is a vulvar moisturizer. I just use coconut oil and that works fine for me. But I've never heard that recommendation before.
Thank you. Yeah, I've not either. Okay, Dr. Baroque, I'm coming to you next, and I want you to touch on the previous question, and then if you wanted to add anything, go ahead.
Okay, I don't know if my hand is raised or not.
It looked like it was for a moment, but I wanted to tap into the bike question. I think for one of the lubricants that I traditionally suggest a lot of times is Uberlube for silicone base. I agree with Dr. Weber. And one of the things I like about Uberlube is not only can it be used in sexual activity, but even runners can sometimes use it for chafing resistance. And although you're sitting and not necessarily doing that same friction movement as running, that might be a good option for like reducing friction and just kind of that. And it's obviously already safe for the vulva and vagina. So it's not necessarily one that would be that I would seem to be a negative aspect if you're trying to see like, what could I use that without having to like apply my steroid during activity or something like that. I did want to, we were discussing, now I lost my train of thought. We were talking
it's
about.
Okay. It's okay. The question was, what are some of the PT reasons that they may be experiencing pain after sex?
Thank you. I got all on the bike and I was like, we were talking about something. Okay, so when it comes to burning sensations, so sometimes nerves can play a heavy role in burning. And what I mean by that is the pudendal nerve is one of the primary nerves that have function within the pelvic floor. The pelvic floor muscles are innervated by they move because of the pudendal nerve, right? But they also have some sensory, meaning the sensation aspect of things that happen to the vulva as well. Well, for one, if you're having sex, the muscles of the pelvic floor are the muscles that rhythmically move up during an orgasm. And they're the ones that rhythmically move up during, you know, when you're aroused, they can start to become more taut and tender. Well, not necessarily tender, but restricted. And that can add added pressure onto the nerves. Now, if you already have an underlying fear or guarding that happens, like Dr. Weber was saying, some people will tolerate a speculum assessment. I find the same thing to happen with dilators. Like people will naturally progress in their dilator. And then when it comes to sex, then they'll find that they have restriction. And so with that, usually I would say there's more than just a physical component to this. And that's when you have to kind of navigate your relationship with what is making me guarded about this. Is this like anticipatory pain versus it being a situation where somebody is feeling like there's a physical restriction in that? And that goes back to discussing those things with an intimacy or sex therapist to kind of navigate your thoughts around that. But if it's after and you're feeling that, there's a lot of things. There could be restriction around the clitoris. So the clitoris has a lot of nerve endings, and it, just like a penis would, expands and should kind of, increase in size during arousal. And so that compression on the nerves can sometimes then cause a lot of like upper, above like your vulva region, cramping and aching after sex. And also it could cause a lot of more of burning in the clitoris. So you do, like whenever there's fusions around the clitoris, you might, that's when we would address some clitoral hood mobilization and just make sure that we can make sure that the movement around the clitoris is efficient. And that's when that self-exploration becomes also kind of important, because then you're increasing blood flow to the clitoris beforehand so that it's able to expand and have a little bit more flexibility in the skin and the tissue around the clitoris, around the vaginal opening, and reduce the likelihood of having burning after, because stretching has already occurred. And it's not like a sudden thing. It's a progressive thing.
Thank you. Again, going back to the All Access Pass, we have a video on nerve pain, vulvar nerve pain. So it's an hour of education on that from a pelvic floor PT. And then we also have one on managing sexual pain. So, and that was Dr. Baruch's session. And she goes in depth on all of this and more. And then we also have a whole session on just pelvic floor PT in general. Now, I know we are running out of time. We've got about 11 minutes left, but we have a whole hour on how does pelvic health PT help when you have lichen sclerosis, right? It's going to be very, very, it's a skin condition, but there's still a lot that goes on in the pelvic floor. So I do want to, we're getting a lot of questions around pregnancy. So pregnancy and menopause, I also have 2 hour sessions talking specifically about pregnancy and one on menopause in that bonus. So if you are here, you want this bonus, you want to get in on this Holistic Healing Summit bonus now. So I put that link in there, but let's talk about pregnancy real quick. How does lichen sclerosis affect pregnancy? Can you have a normal pregnancy when you have lichen sclerosis? So I'm going to start with you, Dr. Weber.
Absolutely. Yes, you absolutely can. If you need to be treated during pregnancy, it's safe to do so, again, using steroids in a small amount to the vulvar area is going to be fine. It's not, you're going to absorb very little. It's not going to be a concern for the pregnancy. You know, one issue may be with scarring. I've diagnosed women with lichen sclerosis in pregnancy. It hasn't been terrible LS in pregnancy where the vaginal opening or introitus was extremely scarred. Sometimes, you know, having a vaginal delivery, if somebody has, I mean, you can have more pelvic floor issues after that, but if there is restrictive tissue and things like that, sometimes a vaginal delivery can help because the vaginal, you know, you're going to have a baby through there. But I haven't really had anybody where it's caused any issues with their pregnancy or with their delivery, fortunately. So.
Dr. Barocca, I know I've heard pregnant people talk about perianal massages that have helped them with their pregnancy. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, one of the things about it is, well, you know, the research kind of is here, neither here nor there when it says like, oh, it's inconclusive. Does this really help or not? What I can say about it is it doesn't hurt. So, I mean, there's various ways to do perineal massages. There is with your hand. There's also with things like a vaginal wand that kind of allows for, because reaching in the vulvar region can be kind of challenging. Also, one of the things that is really helpful is breathing mechanics and understanding how to release your pelvic floor. So many times what happens is people are, you know, taught to push, you know, and hold their breath and bear down during birth. And they should actually be breathing in and then exhaling through the mouth and letting their muscles of their stomach help push the uterus as a contraction is occurring versus it being a situation where they are closing their throat and pushing down. That kind of force can very well impact perineal tears or tearing, as many people say, like, oh, did you tear after birth? That could impact it because of the level of force that you're using. Also, if your gynecologist, your OB-GYN is comfortable with you trying various positions, your positioning during birth can really help set the pelvis up in a different position so that like the traditional hospital-based position, which they call dorsal thonion, when you're on your back and your legs are in the air, that can sometimes not allow the tailbone or your sacrum to kind of move out of the way, which causes added pressure in that introital opening region. So sometimes being in different positions, like in a deep squat position or holding your partner and doing breath work, or being in on all fours where you have a little bit more support, can then change the position of the tailbone so that the pelvic cavity is more open and there's less tissue. Even if you have tissue restriction at the vulva, you might have more movement occur, which reduces the strain on tissue that might not be moving as optimally as you might like.
Thank you. Go ahead, Jacqueline.
I'll keep this brief because I agree with both Mamela and Dr. Weber. So we've talked about, you know, perineal work and massaging. We've talked about safety with respect to steroids. So one thing I wanted to quickly highlight on the topic of VLS and pregnancy is symptoms, particularly because there was a new paper published by Schaefer et al. In 2023, so last year, and this was probably the biggest study we've had on VLS in pregnancy patients before. It was usually case studies, maybe 10 people. This one had 134, I believe, or something close to that. And they looked at all these different metrics. And again, I'm not going to get into all of them. One thing I wanted to highlight, this study showed that in this group, symptoms actually improved and people felt better during pregnancy, but symptoms really got worse postpartum. And so I think one takeaway from this is patient education. particularly on the provider side, about postpartum, because what would happen and what's common, to have the baby, now you're a new parent and everything is new and you're not sleeping and you're tired. So you're probably not remembering to use your steroids as often. You may not be taking care of your body the way that you used to. And so treatment and vulvar care and all of that are kind of an afterthought. And that's kind of, you know, one hypothesis as to why these symptoms kind of increase postpartum. So I think there's a need for, you know, when healthcare providers are talking to patients about pregnancy, also having these conversations about postpartum and how to set them up for success postpartum so that they're not having that increase of symptoms afterwards.
Great point. Absolutely. Especially with your breastfeeding, I hear a lot that, you know, the symptoms come back. So another question, another group of questions that we've got have been around menstruation, periods, symptoms getting worse around their periods. Can you guys talk about why that might be? What can we do? What can they do to help alleviate that? I want to start with you, Dr. Weber, and then I'll go to Jacqueline.
Yeah, I think a lot of medical conditions around a woman's menstrual cycle can be exacerbated at that time. And we know throughout the menstrual cycle, there are hormonal fluctuations, increase in progesterone after ovulation, decline in estrogen if fertilization doesn't occur. And a lot of women sometimes just have different types of discharge, or they feel like the pH of the vagina changes right before their menstrual cycle. And then, of course, during the first week of the menstrual cycle. So it can be a common time of more itching, irritation, discharge or odor, changes like that in general. I haven't really had anybody come to me with a certain type of regimen, but probably if there's more dryness, like Jacqueline said, stepping up your use of your emollients, your barriers, more rinsing, things like that, just trying to remove all of the irritants. And then of course, with your menstrual cycle, of looking at what you're using and trying to, if you use pads, trying to find something that has a certain type of fiber or doesn't have chlorine or other things that might be irritating to your skin. I have a lot of patients that use menstrual cups. They find those to be really helpful because then they don't have to wear the pads as well. Also would like to mention that if this isn't related to the period, but there are different types of pads. There's pads that are made for menstruation. There's pads that are made for urine leakage, you know, and those are different for different scenarios. So you shouldn't be interchanging those, but I'd like to hear what anybody else has to say about things they do during menstruation to help with their LS.
Go ahead, Jacqueline.
Yeah, so I've definitely heard this a lot in the community where people who are still menstruating will say, I don't know why, but I swear there's a connection between my hormones and what's going on there and my symptoms. So there's two trends that I tend to hear in the community. So one is that symptoms get worse around ovulation, and the other one is either right before menstruation or during menstruation. There are people that feel better when they menstruate. So clearly it's highly individualized how we experience our symptoms within our cycle. I do think, you know, there's something to say there. Kathy just dropped a link to a video that I did with Dr. Corey Babb on the topic of hormones and the different ways that this can manifest in symptoms and what we can do. I do know some people in the community whose doctors will have them strategically use birth control in order to skip periods every now and then to give them some relief. Now, of course, remember that anything treatment-wise comes with risk and benefit, and that's always a conversation that should be had between patient and healthcare provider to determine your own personal level of risk. Not everybody wants birth control, and that's okay. So that's one option. There is the option to discuss vaginal estrogen, potentially seeing if that can help, especially if you experience your symptoms where when the estrogen levels tend to take a nice dive. There is, what else is there? There's I'm trying to remember what else Dr. Babb said, but I would highly recommend checking out that video because he walks us through a bunch of different scenarios that you can explore if you're having issues around your period. And then I do want to echo what Dr. Weber was saying. For a lot of people with LS, right, our skin can already be quite prone to irritation. And so then if we've got blood on it and the blood's drying on our vulva, that can be quite irritating. So do definitely agree with kind of using a peri bottle or something to kind of remove that excess blood and buildup on the skin. That can be helpful. I've always discouraged pad use. I just find them very, very irritating. And in a lot of the literature on dermatitis, vulvar dermatitis, you'll see pads as being the culprit. Of course, if pads needs to be an option for you, then again, what Dr. Weber was saying, unbleached, no chlorine, just, you know, be mindful of the type that you're purchasing. So those can be really helpful too. If you don't have a peri bottle, sometimes I'll just like sit in the bath. In terms of what what menstrual products I use, I, for the longest time, just used nothing because my periods are so light. But now I've really taken a liking to period underwear, which I didn't think I was going to like at first because I thought that gusset area was just going to be like thick cardboard. And I thought it was going to be incredibly uncomfortable, but it's very, very comfortable. And I like them more than my regular underwear. So I'm very thrilled with that. But there are other options like menstrual cups, discs, other things that you can use in place of pads that tend to be more irritating to the skin. So again, just trying to find what works for you and your body is the thing. And talking to your doctor about potentially discussing different hormonal options that could help alleviate symptoms during this time. I finally remembered the other thing that Dr. Babb mentioned. One time, I believe this is what Dr. Babb mentioned, was potentially slightly increasing the steroid dose the week before. So you kind of know when your symptoms start to flare. So let's say you're on a maintenance of twice a week. Maybe you do every other day during that period when your symptoms are worse, and then you just go right back into maintenance. Again, these are all things to explore, things to talk to your healthcare provider, make sure that you understand the benefit and the risk of using your medication in this way. We never want to just blindly do what somebody else is doing, right? So always inform discussions with your healthcare provider.
Thank you. And Dr. Baruch, is there anything from a pelvic floor perspective that we can do to help when we are experiencing pain or anything like that from our periods?
I actually agree with everything that Jacqueline and Dr. Weber mentioned. I definitely think there is a hormonal component, but just like people can have different, you know, sensations, like people feel, and I'm going to transition this to kind of sex and on your cycle. You know, there's some people that are more aroused during their cycle and then other people are less aroused, and that a lot could be a big component of hormones. And I think the same goes with your different emotions as well as how your skin changes and, you know, how some people break out more. Like there's a pretty strong component that has to do with the hormones. But yes, definitely changing from pads to maybe a menstrual cup or and I would say like one of the other things is things can be very moist during that time. And so if your exercise routine is you're a person that usually goes out right after you work out or something like that, that might be a good time that you're extra cautious about changing right after, because just having even more moisture. I mean, this can play a role whether you're on your cycle or not, with people feeling a little bit more irritable right after their cycle. I mean, right after exercise or physical activity.
Thank you. I know we are a little bit past time. We've got two more questions that I want to make sure we cover, and then we will go ahead and end it here. Like I said, we are going to have so much more information at this year's Holistic Healing Summit. So please make sure you have your ticket. There are free options as well as a mid-tier option, but your all access pass is going to get you all of the goods, all of the goods. So the next question I want to ask is in particular about anal LS. I know we kind of brushed on it, but can you give us, Dr. Weber, how do we treat anal LS that may be
a little different than our vulvar LS, particularly if we have like fissures, anal fissures, and things like that. Can you tell us what's the difference?
Sure, especially if there's anal fissures, you know, it can be the skin needs to be treated, and the skin with the LS is just more prone to tearing, but there can be a lot of underlying issues for anal fissures as well. So one thing would be straining, constipation. If bowel movements are really hard or firm, then employing things to help keep the stool softer or mushier so that there's not tearing of that skin. So you can try things like magnesium oxide or magnesium citrate. Sometimes those can kind of naturally help with fecal consistency. There are stool softeners like docosate sodium, increasing your fiber, taking probiotics. All of those things may help you stay on a regular bowel movement, softer bowel movement frequency schedule. That can help a lot. But also over time, sometimes those muscles, underlying muscles, are spasming, especially if there's been a lot of pain and a lot of tearing. And so sometimes I've prescribed topical things for anal fissures, things that do, you know, if you're using a steroid down there, you probably don't need that. But for women, if they're maybe not using a steroid every day, things like Anusol with hydrocortisone, which is a weaker steroid, might be used. And sometimes we'll compound different creams. I'm not a huge fan of compounding because those are prescriptions that aren't regulated by the FDA, but sometimes certain products can help sort of relax that area a little bit. And then sometimes if the fissures aren't getting better, and I really think that the LS is under control, then I'll refer patients to see colorectal surgeons to see if there's something that might need to be done, like a sphincterotomy or cutting that sphincter. But that usually a surgical intervention is going to be the last resort. But some of those compounded topicals and a really good bowel regimen can help in addition to treating the skin.
And I want to ask, do you recommend if someone has vulvar LS and then they start getting like these fissures and itching around the anus, just going ahead and putting steroids down there? Or what's your recommendation if they don't have an anal LS diagnosis yet, but they do have vulvar LS?
So if they're, so I guess I'm confused. So if they are having anal symptoms.
Right. But right. They haven't had someone look down there and say, you have anal LS,
right,
but they do have vulvar LS. Is it okay for them to just go ahead and treat with the steroids?
Yeah. Well, I think if there's new symptoms, so there's anal symptoms or perianal symptoms, or there's something that wasn't someone's typical LS presentation, then they need to be seen and they need an exam with their whoever's treating them for their LS and who's recognized that. And, you know, certainly I think there's a lot of people out there with LS that have symptoms before we can see anything. And so I will often have them just using the same type of, you know, hygiene practices. And then I will have them use the clobetasol as well. I mean, we can see in a lot of patients that typical hourglass, you know, or figure of eight. We know that the skin around the perianus can be involved. And for a lot of my patients that don't have lichen sclerosis that come in with some perianal symptoms, I'll treat them with steroids very closely. Sometimes I'll alter the frequency, or I'll have them just treat for a couple of weeks and come back. And sometimes just a short-term treatment can help, but I don't see any harm with them using the steroids down in that region to see if it helps. But, you know, having ruled out some other kind of source that's maybe not LS, that could be something else like a hemorrhoid or an anal dysplasia or precancer or something else like that, we have to rule that stuff out first.
So just to be clear, don't just apply your steroid. You need to be seen first and then have your doctor kind of monitor you through that process to keep an eye on you as they're testing and then you're trying things. Okay.
Agree. Yeah, I think anytime there's new symptoms that it needs to be reevaluated so you're not missing something else that can be happening concurrently.
Absolutely. Thank you. And then the last question was, going back to bike riding, there were quite a few people who were interested in bike riding with LS. So if any of you have any kind of tips, tricks that people can use to, you know, get back into bike riding. Spring is coming, summer is coming, or spring is here, summer is coming, and we want to get out there and ride our bikes. What are some tips that you guys can give us to get us back on that bike? I'm going to start with you, Jacqueline, because I know we've discussed this before.
So anything I say is not coming from a bike rider. I lift weights. That's what I do. Bike riding is not what I do. The closest thing I come, I guess, is like doing the rowing machine, I guess, because I'm sitting. That's the closest. So what I'm sharing is more community wisdom than my lived experience, just because I don't really cycle that much. So first of all, I love the idea of using Uber Lube as a kind of protectant against any chafing and rubbing. Other tips would be to look at your seat and potentially change up your seat, either getting a wider seat with more cushion. And again, remember that everybody is different, right? Our bodies are different, our needs are different. So some people prefer a wider seat. Some people get the seat where there's almost like a cutout, like it's empty where the vulva would be, kind of like a donut pillow, but in a bike seat. Some people prefer those. So go to an actual bike shop and look at the different seats and try and see what you think sounds like a good idea for you and your body. There used to be this product. I don't know if it's available, but you can probably find something similar. It's called a silly saddle. And it's essentially this little silicone insert that you would basically put in your underwear. So it's you know, not super thick, but it's basically creating this like soft protective barrier between you and the seat. Again, trying to decrease any friction, take some pressure off of the vulvar area. I think maybe I do spin classes. So maybe if you're biking occasionally, getting up off your seat might help. And biking when you're standing. So doing a mix of standing and seated biking just to sometimes take the pressure off if there are any issues there. So those are kind of like the big community wisdom things. And then, you know, just make sure that you're taking care of yourself afterwards. So you went for your bike ride, you stored your bike, you get in. If you're a little tender, again, maybe a cold compress, maybe a warm bath, and then applying a really nice, generous layer of emollient, just making sure to continue that kind of overall vulvar care.
Thank you. Any tips, Dr. Weber or Dr. Baruch?
I think you hit a lot of it. I would just add on there
afterwards to really try some various pelvic floor stretches. And that is something like a deep pelvic squat. And that's going into child's pose where you're kind of facing with your legs open in a wide or happy baby where you're kind of holding your hips out. Now, everyone can't get in any of those positions, all of those positions. So sometimes if getting in a deep squat is uncomfortable to people, I might tell them to use something a little bit elevated, like a yoga block, because they're firmer, but they're not necessarily hard. And that just allows you to release your pelvic floor a little bit easier because you're not holding up your body because it's hard to get in that position. And why I would say this is not necessarily because your pelvic floor is the reason causing the itching, but if you are itchy and uncomfortable and tender, you're more than likely going to be carrying or holding your tension up. So we want to remember that anytime you've been doing any form of exercise, you should then make sure that your muscles are able to release and let go, just like you would if you just finished doing some stretches for your legs. You'd want to stretch your hamstrings and your quad. You should definitely release your pelvic floor by just going into those positions and taking good quality breaths into your belly. If you don't know how to do that, I highly suggest at least seeing a pelvic floor therapist to learn the techniques and strategies so that you can apply them to your life.
And how about from a gynecological perspective, Dr. Weber? Any tips or tricks?
No, I mean, I think that all sounds great. I don't really have anything to add.
Awesome. Well, guys, we went a little over, but we had an amazing time. Thank you so much for all of the amazing questions. I hope you learn something new. I hope you feel a little lighter, a little bit more excited for your journey to remission, because I believe everyone can get there. Just keep trying new things. You never know. That next thing might be the thing that gets you there. Pain-free sex, all of it. I hold out hope for everyone. I know there was a question in the survey about how do you talk to your partner, family about LS. Get your ticket for the Holistic Healing Summit, because that is our whole theme this year. Relationships. How do you have those conversations? How do you keep those relationships? Not just with your partner, but we're talking about family, friends, boss. How do you tell your boss, I need to take more breaks. I need to take longer breaks. I need to sit down or I need to walk around. All of these things, we're going to be talking about it. Make sure you get your ticket. Thank you so much. We will, if you want the recording so you can go back and listen to all this amazing knowledge all over again, we will be emailing that to you tomorrow. And thank you, thank you, thank you for everyone who left a donation. We truly, truly appreciate it. It helps us so much. Thank you and have an amazing rest of your day. And we'll talk to you next time.
Thank you. Bye.
Bye. Thank you.
Bye. Thank you, panelists. You were amazing.